Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report Under Lockdown. Thank you for joining us today. I am very excited that on today's show, it's not just going to be me. We are joined by Michael Shore. Michael, how's it going?
I'm great, John. How you doing? Good to be on TDR.
Good to have you on. You've appeared more since we've gone under quarantine than in like the year since. And so thank you for being available to us. I attribute a lot of it to you not being able to travel around the country.
Well, that's true. But it's, you know, it's always good to be here, and I'm glad we have the time. And now that the nominating race is over, I'm imagining that I'll be able to do it even when quarantine expires.
Exactly. And the people in the chat, as they're acknowledging right now, we do know that the mics are hot during the beginning. We're just joking around. And I could easily fix it. I just haven't. It's only been 4 weeks. I'll get around to it at some point. But anyway, on today's episode of the show, we are going to be going over one of the most bonkers interviews I've ever seen from a politician, and that's the mayor of Las Vegas speaking with Anderson Cooper. Just crazy stuff there. But we've also got the future of Republican governors reopening their states. What direction is that going to go? Donald Trump decided to throw a little bit of a curveball, but we're going to have a little bit of a debate about how likely it is that that will stick. Wisconsin, their election that they decided to have in-person voting for, thanks to an assist from the Republican State Party and the Supreme Court, we are now finding out more about those who were, in fact, infected with coronavirus, apparently during that time. All that and more, we've got lots that we're going to be talking about. And for those of you who are already here, I got two things you need to do. One is hit the like button so that more people know that we're live, and also ring the bell so that you can get our notifications if you're not already doing so. And the other is you should definitely tune in later today, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, the rerun of this week's episode of True North, where my co-host Shivala Madlina visits a ghost town on the island of Svalbard, like 1,000 miles north of Norway. And it's an awesome episode, lots of cool wildlife, very spooky, and that'll be replaying each day. And new episodes will come out every Monday, so definitely look forward to that as well. And with that, Michael, why don't we launch into the first story?
Let's go to Vegas.
Let's go to Vegas. But it's not going to stay there. Unfortunately, it got out.
Yes, it did.
Okay, let's talk about this. The mayor of Las Vegas spoke with Anderson Cooper about her desire to see the casinos and the strip packed once again with tourists and people gambling and having fun, despite the obvious cost there. There's a number of clips we want to show you. Here is the first.
You're talking about encouraging hundreds of thousands of people to come to Las Vegas.
Back.
I get the financial losses people are suffering, which is awful. But you're encouraging, hundreds of thousands of people coming there in casinos, smoking, drinking, touching slot machines, breathing circulated air, and then returning home to states around America and countries around the world. Doesn't that sound like a virus petri dish? I mean, how is that?
No, what it sounds like, you're being an alarmist. I'm not. I've lived a long life. I grew up in the heart of Manhattan. I know what it's like to be with subways and on buses and crammed into elevators. I think you are by saying what you have just said.
Anyway, Michael, so I think Anderson Cooper is right to point out that effectively it seems like this is a best case scenario from the perspective of the virus that you would, in this very particular context that is packed with people who are drunk and they're smoking and they're walking around, they're all touching the same things. It seems like an absolute disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, I mean, Vegas and gambling is predicated on closeness and monitoring, right? You don't want people spread out. They have their systems of monitoring and security and all of that. And gambling is an intimate, like you said, everybody touching different dice and cards, et cetera. It's an absurd idea on the part of Mayor Goodman. And I like Mayor Goodman saying that she grew up in Manhattan as if that's a qualifier. Because Manhattan is where, you know, the worst of the worst is happening in the United States. And also,
that's true.
Anderson Cooper grew up there as well. So it's not like she's trumping him in any way there. It's just crazy.
And he's right there right then, too, right?
Right. He's sitting.
So he's experiencing it. Yeah, it's a terrible idea. And it ended up being, as you're going to see as we play more for the audience, it ended up being an absolute disaster of an interview. It should probably end her career, that she's being given this opportunity to do the right thing and is so brazenly choosing not to. And he's offering up early opportunities in the interview to get her to change course, to continually remind her of what the human cost is going to be, but she rejects that opportunity. So we're going to move to the second clip. So this is going to have to do with the disconnect between saying you want to reopen but have social distancing, considering how difficult it is going to be to do that in Vegas of all places.
How do you do that in a casino?
That's up to them to figure out. I don't own a casino. I don't know anything
about
building a casino.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. You're the mayor of Las Vegas, and you want casinos to be open, even though you have no authority, thankfully, over casinos. But you say open them up, but you have no responsibility about how that would be done safely?
No, you're blurring. No, you're blurring.
You said it's not your job.
There. I am not a private owner of a hotel. I wish I were. And I would have the cleanest hotel with 6 feet figured out for every human being comes
so
in there.
If you can't figure out how to do this safely, why, as mayor of a city that you were responsible for the people's safety, are you calling for something that you have no plan for how it would be done safely?
I am not a private owner. That's the competition in this country, the freedom, the free enterprise, and to be able to make sure that what you offer the public meets the needs of the public. Right now, we're in a crisis health-wise, and so for a restaurant to be open or a small boutique to be open, they better figure it out. That's their job. That's not the mayor's job.
Okay, so my question is, she gives the example of a restaurant or a small boutique when she knows that what we're talking about are massive hotels, massive casinos, streets packed with people. She acknowledges that she doesn't have any idea or clue and doesn't appear to want to have any idea of how you would actually enforce social distancing in that situation. It's not the thing that bothers me the most is not just that she holds this position. It's that she seems to think that this is a winner, that her coming out and speaking in this way is going to reflect well on her and on the future of the city if they go along with this path.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's more at play here. Her husband was the mayor of Las Vegas for 12 years before she was mayor. I think that when you look at what the casino owners are doing, they're scrambling right now. She's probably trying to curry favor with them to say, I tried. So there is something in the back there. I mean, it's still foolish, and they understand that it's foolish. And just the mere fact that the mayor of Las Vegas wants casinos open has no, as Cooper pointed out, has no bearing on whether or not they will open. It's just sort of, you know, paying bad lip service to it. It just makes her look bad, and it's not going to change what happens in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, I've been wondering, for instance, with Georgia, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, how willing these businesses will be to open up, knowing that potentially infections could be traced back to their locations. Would they actually want that? And I don't know, for all businesses, I am worried that the bigger the business is, the more willing they might be to do that, especially if they're losing a lot of money, as I'm sure the casinos probably are. And so I worry, like, that she can easily say, well, you know, it's private industry and it's on them to decide and they'll do what's right for their customers. Well, that doesn't really seem to have borne out through the history of our country over the past couple of hundred years.
No. And the truth is you have to have successful casinos. There's so much more that's in play, right? The airlines have to be running. People have to be willing to fly. People have to be willing to stay in hotels that are sanitized, but not to the level that they have been hoping to sanitize their own homes and keep themselves safe. On top of that, there has to be a willingness to go and be among people and that has to come from people with money, because these casinos are losing money and they're going to want people to come back and spend their money and gamble their money there. So there's across the board a way of looking at this that is certainly going to make it unlikely that any of this is going to happen, anything that Carolyn Goodman wants to happen. Las Vegas is probably the biggest one industry city in America, so their desperation is clear. But of course, they have to rely on so many other things to be working in order for them to be successful, too.
So the mayor of Las Vegas, she's looking horrible after this Anderson Cooper interview. And in part, it's because she's not just advocating for, a relatively soon return to normal, you know, economic activity. It's that she seems incredibly willing and explicitly willing to use the people who would be in Las Vegas as some sort of, like, a part of an experiment that we would be conducting. Now, if you think that I'm going too far in that, take a look at this clip.
Every one of those lives is a tragic loss. But when you count 150 versus 2.3 million, you have to say, we have to open up. We have to go back. Our bus drivers, our room cleaners.
But hasn't it been because of social distancing that the numbers have been what they are?
How do you know until we have a control group? We offer to be a control group. Anybody who knows anything about statistics knows that, for instance, you have a vaccine.
You're offering the citizens of Las Vegas to be a control group to see if your theory on social distancing works or doesn't work.
Wrong. Absolutely wrong. Don't put words in my mouth.
You just said we'll be a control group.
Excuse me. What I said was, I offered to be a control group, and I was told by our statistician, you can't do that because people from all parts of Southern Nevada come in to work in the city. And I said, oh, that's too bad, because I know when you have a disease, you have a placebo that gets the water and the sugar, and then you get those that actually get the shot. We would love to be that placebo side so you have something to measure against.
Oh my God. He's just like the whole time. And I have to admit, I had a similar look. So Michael, I'll give you first crack at her little scientific theory that she's sketching out there.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it is like they say that we offered to be. It's not that these tourists will be. It's the people of Las Vegas would be, because people wouldn't come to Las Vegas. So she's actually offering, as mayor of a city, she says she's offered them as a control group. Dina Titus, who represents Las Vegas in Congress, was outraged by this. She said she doesn't want her constituents to be a control group, to be a petri dish. And that's essentially what's happening here. It was the biggest unwinding of any political conversation I've ever seen. Or, I mean, that's probably hyperbole, but it was one of the bigger ones, because she kept getting deeper into the problem that she created there. So the fact that everyone in Las Vegas knows that she is that she has offered them up in this way is totally unsatisfying politically. But also the idea that, you know, that she did this and it was rejected and now she's going public with it, it digs her into an even deeper hole. It's just crazy talk. I can't believe it's the most politically tone deaf and sort of humanly tone deaf thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, we've had some interviews like that with Donald Trump, but outside of Donald Trump, generally people don't talk in this way. And I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm willing to let people die. Lots of politicians are shockingly coming out in support of that. It's another to say, like, she got right up to the line of, I want to see what happens when this spreads. Or at least I'm willing, for scientific curiosity, I'm willing to see what happens when lots of people get coronavirus thanks to my advocacy and my actions, which is just madness. I will also say, for anyone who knows statistics, I ask you a question. Do you think she knows anything about statistics? Because I don't think that she does. I don't think she really knows what a placebo is. She's using it in a really weird way. In this case, she asked one of her statistics people, can we do this? And they said no. And the reason they gave is because, what, it wouldn't be scientifically valid because people from outside of just Las Vegas would also be there? That's the reason we can't do this, they came up with. I have a few others that are a little bit more obvious, a little bit more grounded in sort of a basic respect for human rights and people's ability to not be killed for just living in an area. No, it's an absolute disaster. We're gonna play one more. I will say, I know a lot of people are saying, you know, her re-election chances are shot because of this. Well, unfortunately, she's term limited. She doesn't have to run again. Maybe one of the reasons she's willing.
She is term limited, but she also has a son, Ross Goodman, who's a prominent attorney in Las Vegas. Her husband was mayor. She's mayor. There's always talk that Ross Goodman is going to run for mayor. I think the Goodman name may be tarnished in Las Vegas.
They may not have a good name anymore in terms of politics. Let's play one more, because Anderson Cooper hits her up with one of the big responses that almost everyone has had to a politician who said, you all need to potentially die to help the economy. So he kept asking her over a period of like a minute and a half, will you be in the casinos every night if they decide to reopen? And she was not ready to answer that. She didn't want to. So he put it to her at near the end.
I haven't heard you say yes, that you would be sitting on those casino floors every night along with the people that you say you are holding their hands with.
What is the purpose of that? First of all, I have a family.
Because it would be putting your money, it would be putting money where your mouth is.
What would be the purpose of that? And I have a family. Well, it's good that, you know, if we were to go ahead with this, Vegas would just be packed with people who aren't related to anyone. So no concern there.
Right. And it's the least mayoral thing to do. At the ground level, that's what mayors do. Whenever there's something happening in their city or town, they go with it, right? If there's a snowstorm that cripples New York, the mayors are walking through New York, not taking their their car. If there's an event that happens in a small town that makes it impossible to know, I can't even think of what it is, but the mayors are involved. If this were opened up and Mayor Goodman was too afraid to go to the casino, that speaks volumes, and it certainly wouldn't be good politically.
No, not at all. Look, I don't know what's going to end up happening with her son. I don't know her son's politics. I will say that I'm generally opposed to dynasties. I think that this is a great case study in why perhaps feeling assured of your position and your future might not be a great thing for politicians, people who are supposed to be servants of the American people, instead feeling as if they are indeed rulers over a certain segment of the population. Just an absolutely devastating interview. I hope that what's up?
The Goodmans are a control group for what you just said, for your theory of why
that's
dynasty
true.
Politics
are. I hope that one silver lining that comes out of this is that her so cruelly and clumsily, like bizarrely putting forward this theory of why we need to reopen, hopefully that will provide a shock to the system that gets people to see through some of the slightly more sophisticated but just as cruel arguments for reopening other areas of the country. That's my hope.
Yeah, no question. And it also, it does speak to whatever she said, the craziness there. It also speaks to the desperation of Las Vegas right now. It is a city whose only industry based, and you know, there's everything in Las Vegas, but it is about the gaming industry. As it's been crippled, it has really had a ripple effect on that city, maybe more than any other. And that speaks to the desperation, but it's only people from Las Vegas that are going to be in trouble. It's because people are not going to come in large masses. People don't have disposable income right now to go to Las Vegas and throw it on a craps table. So it really is a terrible, terrible idea.
That is true. Yeah. Yeah. And that's like with all these politicians who are trying to do their best to give this virus the best chance of maintaining its stranglehold in America. Hopefully the American people will not go along with it. That is my hope going forward.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump has been very outspoken over the past week or so about the need for protests against these governors that have been stripping the American people of their rights by forcing them to social distance. He's been sending out the tweets of liberating different states. Small coincidence, it's all the states with Democratic governors. And he's previously been very supportive of Republican governors in getting rid of their social distancing. But that appears to have changed yesterday. Talking about Brian Kemp reopening Georgia effectively between Friday and Monday, he had this to say yesterday. "I want him to do what he thinks is right, but I disagree with him on what he is doing. I think it's too soon." And he went on to say, "I love those people that use all of those things, the spas, the beauty parlors, barbershops, tattoo parlors. I love them, but they can wait a little bit longer, just a little bit, not much, because safety has to predominate." So that's an about face. I mean, from liberate Wisconsin to, you know what, let's wait.
Right. And you know, there's no rhyme or reason to any of it, right? I mean, you could look into the relationship that Kemp and Trump have had. Trump really, by endorsing Kemp, handed him the nomination for governor. in Georgia. He came back. He was Secretary of State, came back against Casey Cagle, who was the lieutenant governor. And so there was this love there. But then Trump wanted Doug Collins to be named to the Senate seat that opened up in Georgia. Instead, Kemp named Kelly Loeffler. That's an entirely different story now, but went against the president. So, you know, the president, you wouldn't talk about this necessarily with every president, but personal relationships and personal slights. I mean, look at Mitt Romney being the only person not on the on the committee to reopen the country, really.
Exactly.
So I think that, that matters to this president. So I think his love for Brian Kemp, when Brian Kemp didn't name Doug Collins the senator there, was really upsetting to Trump. And now you're seeing it bear out.
Exactly. And look, I want to believe that hypothetically, whatever the reason is, and we're going to provide some reasons coming from sources that know Donald Trump. So maybe the fact that he's suddenly changing, we know that the Republican Party, for the most part, and definitely the Republican base, they are willing to just do and believe whatever Trump tells them to. And most of them will be able to get through that with a minimum of cognitive dissonance. And so maybe if he's now against it, then Republican governors won't go ahead with it, which they had been previously getting ready to do. It doesn't look like that's the case here, because Governor Kemp went on to tweet earlier today, "I discussed Georgia's plan to reopen shuttered businesses for limited operations with POTUS. I appreciate his bold leadership and insight during these difficult times and the framework provided by the White House to safely move states forward. Our next measured step is driven by data and guided by state public health officials. We will continue with this approach to protect the lives and livelihoods of all Georgians." I disagree with most of the latter part of that, but what it means is that even though Trump, at least for yesterday, appears to have changed his position, Brian Kemp has not, and he is indeed going to go ahead with the reopening of Georgia.
Yeah, he seems to think that it would be too politically awkward to then step back and change his mind, sort of in for a penny, in for a pound. But I do think that when you also look at the politics of this, which I like to do, is that Georgia is a purpling state. It's a red state, right? But it's not staunchly red like it was maybe even 5, 6, 7 years ago. And now, as it purples, these issues matter, especially to Donald Trump, who is going to be campaigning there and needing that state to be reliably red when you look at some of these other states that he's starting to lose ground in, including Florida just to the south. So I think that is a part of why Donald Trump is being careful there. This is not playing particularly well with the public. I mean, there were 7% of people, I think, in a poll that supported these protesters that are going to the state houses, without masks on, saying it's time to reopen. When the president sees those numbers, he knows it's not a winning issue. So right in the center of the epicenter of talk like this is Brian Kemp. And so not supporting him is actually pretty politically savvy with a small S there for Trump.
Well, you know what? Let's now try to figure out exactly what's going on. We have a potential explanation as to why he switched so abruptly yesterday. According to CNN, which is fake news, obviously, task force member Dr. Deborah Birx had privately met with Trump right before his daily press briefing to sway him against Kemp's decision because she and the other task force members feared being asked by reporters why the president endorsed the reopening of Georgia's economy while scientists on his panel did not. That seems like the sort of situation where generally he would throw the scientist 100% under the bus. But apparently Dr. Birx told him to change his position, or at least advised him. Another unnamed source says that Dr. Anthony Fauci told his colleagues during a meeting that he cannot defend this publicly. So that is the apparently why he switched. What is interesting is that we also have CNN reporting that President Trump and Vice President Pence both called Brian Kemp on Tuesday night and expressed support and praise for his move to reopen businesses starting on Friday, a source familiar with the call said. So Tuesday night, Brian Kemp gets a call from the president and the vice president saying, good job, very nice. And then Wednesday, he gets thrown under the bus by Trump. I don't know what's coming Thursday night, and I don't think Brian Kemp does either.
No, I don't think so. But I think you have to look at this as encouraging. I think this is actually good news, right? I mean, that Birx and Fauci had enough sway over the president, which is what we want them to have, that he did this about face, if these reports are true. So, however crazy bonkers the man is, the White House is, the governor is, whatever, however you want to define them, somebody's listening to Birx and Fauci, who said, look, if you do this, we're not going to support it. And that was enough for the president. So that's encouraging.
Exactly. And as the chat is acknowledging, me calling them fake news was a joke. I was mocking Trump there. But anyway, look, we're going to have to see because this decision to reopen states, incredibly consequential. I know that they're mostly worried about the political ramifications of it, but we obviously care about the death toll. You know, Florida's got Ron DeSantis, a guy who from the very beginning seems to... There's the side of coronavirus and the side of the people who are trying not to get it. Politicians are lining up on either side. He seems to have not been sure about his loyalties. And if they reopen Florida, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, we found out yesterday, documents that were released, they believe there could be as high as 200,000 additional casualties in just Florida. Right. And so these decisions are incredibly important. They're just about the most important thing that's being discussed these days.
And had Andrew Gillum won that race, you can be sure that he would not be going along with reopening beaches. And he may have been unpopular for it and had his own sort of tragic troubles lately. But the differences that elections make can often be life and death. And I think you're seeing it play out in some of these races. Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Andrew Gillum in Florida, both lost on the same day to very, very conservative Republicans who are very interested right now in reopening their states.
So back when many of the Democratic primaries hadn't yet been fully pushed off until we had a better idea of what was going to happen with the pandemic, we were faced with Wisconsin and the possibility that if in-person voting continued, that some people could be exposed to coronavirus, could become infected, and indeed die. And in the run-up to it, you had people lining up on trying to shut it down, some believing that it should continue. At the time, Democratic Governor Tony Evers called on the GOP-controlled state legislature to consider postponing the election until May 26th, with the majority of in-person voting suspended and voters obtaining absentee ballots by May 19th. Republican lawmakers convened but refused to consider the proposal, and the state Supreme Court sided with the GOP. The U.S. Supreme Court also overturned a lower court ruling to extend the absentee ballot deadline in what journalist Mark Joseph Stern called, quote, one of the most brazen acts of voter suppression in modern times, because we can expect that many people would not have even gotten their absentee ballot by the time that this newly required deadline would have been put in effect. And the entire thing is one of the most disgusting moments in modern voter suppression that I've seen, because all of this concern about the in-person voting, about the absentee ballots, was entirely the Republican Party interfering with an election of the Democratic Party. I understand not every one of the elections was just Democrats, but the vast, vast majority were. The vast majority of the voters were going to be Democrats. And it is absurd that the state Republican Party and the Republican-dominated Supreme Court nationally was able to get involved and to force this, now we're finding out, potentially deadly turn of events.
Well, it was also stupid for the Republicans because it wound up, while we all thought that it was the Democratic race, and we all knew that more Democrats would come out to vote in a Democratic primary, even though by then it had been fairly well established how it was going to turn out, this was about a Supreme Court seat there. And that Supreme Court seat, the Republicans wanted to hold on to an appointment there because they wanted to further suppress the vote for the general election, which is the one they're thinking about more than any of them. They lost that race and they lost it badly. So it came back to bite them in another way. But you know, now you're going to discuss, too, why it was the reason why we all knew that it was a bad idea.
Yeah. And we knew that there was a likelihood that if you had people lining up for long periods of time and in a time when, you know, 99% of the polling places were shut down, and so people had to crowd at the ones that were still open, we knew that people would be exposed to it. And what do you know? Evidence is now coming in showing that some were. At least 19 people in Wisconsin who said they voted in person or worked the polls for the state's April 7th primary election have tested positive for the coronavirus, according to the state health department. The vast majority of the data isn't yet in. Those numbers are almost certainly going to rise. So this is what I was worried about. And those people, many of them refused to show up to work the polls, totally understandably so. Nobody wants to interact with hundreds or thousands of individuals. And so in the end, the National Guard had to be brought in to do some of the manning of that. And perhaps some of them ended up getting sick. Neither the voters nor the National Guard, nobody should have been put in this position. And that's what was being said at the time. It gives me no pleasure whatsoever to talk about this now, to confirm that what we were worried about is turning out to be true.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know that 19 people wouldn't have gotten coronavirus anyway. We don't know how much that changed. But what we do know is that people were saying, don't do this. Doctors were saying, don't do this. The public was saying, don't do this. And they went ahead and did it. And so there has to have been a bad turnout. I'm sorry for the turnout pun, but there has to have been a bad result here because of the fact that they went ahead and did it. And the Republicans were so politically tone deaf, which they're not generally, to have pushed this forward in the way that they did, because that race, that Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, was everything in on that election day. And they lost it when they thought that they were going to win it and they could control the court and they could control a planned voter purge that was going to happen. All of that is over. All of that worked out well for the Democrats, not the Republicans. And on top of that, you have people who got coronavirus because of the fact that they kept the polls open.
Yeah, and look, them going forward with it at the time, that seems like, I mean, the worst outcome of this story. But we have one wrinkle to make it even worse. Wisconsin still plans to go forward with a special election for its 7th congressional district on May 12th. But they say, no, this is going to be different. This is more rural, so the in-person voting is going to have less crowds and stuff like that. Okay, good. It won't be as big of a disaster. Still a disaster. And one
right.
that...
Affecting rural people instead of city people. And yes, there will be polling stations that need to accommodate fewer people. But with what we know now, I mean, how can it not be lesson learned? It's just astonishing.
Yeah, just a goddamn disaster. And we know what needs to be done for future elections, both in terms of these continuing primaries, but also for the national election. It is amazing that the Republican Party is so brazen and has been so successful in their effort to hamper any effort to get our elections ready for the likelihood that coronavirus is still going to be a significant concern come November. If elections are going to proceed in America over the course of the next year, it is likely that even more mail-in voting is going to have to be a part of that to keep people safe and make sure that they can still participate in American democracy. Now, there are some concerns with that. Some states, and indeed Trump, have been resistant to expand it. Others saying that people having to go through the mail, pay for postage, things like that, you shouldn't have to do when we're talking about participation in American democracy. But the post office is reassuring people of one thing. They put out a statement saying it is the Postal Service's policy not to delay the delivery of completed absentee or vote by mail ballots, even if no postage has been affixed or if the postage is insufficient. And they say that in cases where a ballot enters the mail stream without the proper amount of postage, the Postal Service will collect postage from the appropriate Board of Elections. Now, this is just one small part of the entire thing, but they are once again doing the right thing, assuring people that even if there's some sort of mistake or it slips off or it's not sufficient, their vote will still be delivered and hopefully will still be counted.
Right. And the fact that you have to put postage, I know in some states you don't, but you have to put postage on a mail-in ballot is ridiculous anyway. It's a non-poll tax. You shouldn't have to pay or be inconvenienced to vote. And I know that that's idealistic, although it's not terribly idealistic. It's how it should be. It's pretty simple. But the post office has been a partner in making sure the ballots get to where they're going. And very often it's the people that are least equipped to get to a polling place that have to vote by mail in normal elections, as well as those who are out of town. There are plenty of reasons to do it. People prefer it. But the point is, this time, everything has to be in perfect shape so that people can get all of those ballots, and there are going to be many more mail-in ballots in 2020. They got to get it going.
Yeah. And look, the main reason that I wanted to talk about this is I want to have a broader conversation about the Postal Service. I saw a comment from Mark Jorge, who says, if the USPS is still there come November. And that is a question, because the Postmaster General warned lawmakers earlier this month that it could collapse within the next several months if Congress doesn't quickly provide funding, which it seems like, well, that would be relatively easy. I mean, we're in the middle of a crisis. We know that we need the Postal Service, right? And we're dishing money out left and right. The issue is that, according to the Washington Post, Trump threatened to veto the CARES Act, which Congress passed last month, if it included direct relief for the Postal Service. And unless he has a Brian Kempian turnaround on this, it is likely that that sort of threat of a veto will continue for future legislation. And so I'm curious, Michael, based on the conversations that you've had, how likely is it that the aid that the Postal Service has been requesting will actually come in time to save it?
Well, because of what happened last time, there's now more organization in Congress. Jerry Connolly, a representative from Virginia, actually from Massachusetts, but representing Virginia, has made it his goal to make sure that there's going to be language in this next bill covering the Postal Service. And that's important. And it's important because you know, this then becomes a battle with the president, who knows that mail-in ballots are not good for him, perhaps in November, or thinks that that may be the case, because it will mean that more people will have voted than if they're afraid to go to the polls. And more people means that fewer Republicans, generally speaking. The idea that that this could go forward without the Postal Service in it would set up a real battle, because it's not just Democrats who want to support the Postal Service. And the Postal Service, which had been streamlined by Republicans and Democrats together, was actually doing well. They were starting to repair themselves and show some profits that they hadn't seen in a while. This is this can be bipartisan, but the White House has to be part of it. I don't see it holding up a bill, though. I don't think that he's going to grandstand in that way, because there are going to be enough Republicans in Congress who say that we have to do this, otherwise we're in trouble.
I hope so. And I know that a lot of, you know, state level Republicans probably acknowledge that the USPS is even disproportionately necessary for servicing rural voters. The idea, and by the way, specifically laid out in the Constitution that it should exist, that doesn't seem to be much of a stumbling block for them ideologically, pushing for privatization. And there have been some good politicians. I want to give credit to especially Bernie Sanders, who had an online town hall specifically about the future of the Postal Service, how it can be protected. He was the guy, after all, that just a few years ago, one of several politicians who pushed for instituting basically rural banks in postal services as an additional service that would help, again, disproportionately rural and probably conservative areas. And so he has had ideas to keep it afloat and to strengthen it for some time. I hope that the politicians like Bernie Sanders, who've been doing that during this crisis, are successful. I'm glad that you're optimistic.
Yeah, I'm optimistic, not because I think that people have changed their stripes. I'm optimistic because I think that there are going to be enough things in this bill that Republicans will think are important, that they're going to, impress upon the White House that they need to make sure that those things stay in the bill. And having some money for the post office isn't going to kill, it shouldn't kill the bill.
Exactly. We've been talking since the beginning of the pandemic hitting America that the combination of a lack of a sufficient response to it with the just massive number of incarcerated individuals in America was going to end up being a disaster. We have traced the beginning of the spread inside of Rikers, with both prisoners and guards getting sick and dying. And now we've got a model pulled together by researchers, including from the ACLU, showing that this could get a lot worse before it gets better. This collaboration shows that the number of COVID-related deaths will increase twofold if measures are not taken to adequately reduce jail populations. Even if social distancing is strictly followed in every other area of American life, running jails as per usual would potentially cause an additional 100,000 people, both in and outside of jails, to lose their lives. And one of the things I find most interesting about the research that was done here was that they show that a lot of the models that have been used in conversations about the likely spread of coronavirus in America is based off of research and projections done in Europe. And Europe has a lot of similarities with America, but one big difference is that they don't lock up a massive percentage of their population. They show that the models the U.S. uses are based on ones that have tracked cases in countries that experienced coronavirus outbreaks before we did. They didn't have mass incarceration. When you factor in that, we are again talking about hundreds of thousands of people. My fear in this story is that advocating for changes to protect those lives is never going to be popular. You're going to be attacked for doing it. We know that any advocacy for people in prison is going to be met with calls that it's a waste of money. Why are you focusing on those sorts of things? And that's why I think we've seen such a slow response to the spread of coronavirus in prisons already over the course of the past 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's let's open the casinos, but let's not care about the prisons. I mean, I can't listen. There is a bias, understandably, almost naturally, against prisons and the people in them, for societally. But this is a pandemic. This is different, and the bias obviously shouldn't thrive anyway. But in this type of a situation, it's important that everybody is protected. And those are people, the fine print there was people inside and outside of prison. It can be spread because anybody has it anywhere. And that's the important thing about this virus that people are forgetting when they're looking at this prison issue. People have been talking about it in Mississippi. People were talking about it in Louisiana, because that's where they saw a lot of the outbreak that made Louisiana such a flashpoint at the beginning. And it is largely being ignored. And the fact that people are paying attention to it is good now. But in some cases, it's probably too late because it did its damage as a spread already.
Yeah, that's my fear. I mean, you know, in response to seeing this, I started looking back around at some of the early stories and seeing updated numbers. So, for instance, Rikers, as of Monday, or this is generally in New York, 800 city corrections employees had already tested positive and 8 had died. City officials wouldn't break down how many infected officers worked at Rikers, but the union says it accounts for 70 to 80% of the cases, including inmates. There have been 10 deaths and more than 1,200 confirmed cases in the city's jails. And as we always say, that is the actual people who've been tested. And we know that it is still difficult to get tested. New York is doing better than it was before. But if they're distributing tests, I'm afraid that prisons are probably not the places that are getting, you know, the first ones off the boat, so to speak.
That's exactly right. I mean, they're always going to be drawing last straw. And I think in this case, they shouldn't be, obviously, because they can track the spread of coronavirus from prison into the general population. And that shouldn't happen.
Very excited to welcome back to the show after an unfortunately long absence, in part due to the pandemic. One of my favorite people to talk about, and I think almost uniquely qualified to talk about what we are experiencing both inside of the U.S. and internationally right now, the professor at UCLA and author, most recent work, Beyond the Valley, Ramesh Srinivasan. Welcome back to the show.
How are you doing, John? It's nice to connect with you. I missed you guys.
We've missed you too. You know, I got a chance to see the environment you're in, and I will say, I think that you've chosen a good place to weather the storm. I will say that.
I'm trying to shelter in place, but in the midst of nature as much as possible. And there's so much beautiful nature in our state of California and around the world.
Exactly. Yeah, if you can, I highly recommend it. I want to start off by talking about, I mean, you're considering that your past work about trying to get people to understand technologically what's going on around the world, spread accurate information. We've seen a lot of misinformation. Incredibly important, and I would say... misinformation that's going to lead to people making a lot of bad decisions. What have you thought as you've been watching the first, you know, month and a half of the response inside of the U.S. to coronavirus and the ways that different segments of the American population has responded to it? What are some of your thoughts?
I mean, I find it deeply, deeply unfortunate and actually deadly and sociopathic that a pandemic that affects all of us, you know, all of us are in a sense, potentially, you know, contagious and can be affected by this pandemic, that some people would try to use this situation to divide and conquer, to fragment us, to splinter us. And in particular, the conspiracy theories about the World Health Organization, about the epidemiology of the sciences behind this, the rebuttal of you know, what pretty much every major zoologist and other scientist is saying about the origin of this virus, the attempts to link this to hateful action and speech and treatment of Asian people and Asian American people, all of that I find deeply, deeply disturbing. And what we see is happening here again and again and again is this neo-fascist populist turn grafted onto the internet, right? John, we've talked about this before. And what is happening here is people in a very justifiable way feel disenfranchised, they feel alienated, they feel let down by traditional politicians, by neoliberal systems, you know, by elites, quite frankly. And unfortunately, because our health system or lack thereof has been bought out and controlled by private corporations and big pharma, everybody pretty much knows not to trust them. However, what has happened is the baby's been thrown out with the bathwater, and the baby being thrown out with the bathwater means that there's such intense conspiracy theory type material that's out there and going viral. It's going crazy online.
Yeah.
And the algorithms are facilitating all that it's actually splintering us in very fundamental ways where we can't just trust legitimate public health officials, people like in the CDC and the World Health Organization. So here we have, in this moment of pandemic, an opportunity, as Arundhati Roy has pointed out, for it to be a portal to actually change our dynamics so that we have a people-based system of engaging with the internet and a people's-based system of revolutionizing our medical system and our healthcare system. Yeah. And it's sure as hell is time for us to fight for that. And we need to take opportunity right now to fight in a progressive direction for those causes.
I think 100%. And I think that a lot of people's lives are going to depend on how successful we can be. People, unfortunately, I was hoping that as this got more serious, people would at least in terms of self-preservation would start to listen to those who know the most about it. It doesn't seem like, a significant chunk of America is going in that direction, unfortunately. And, a lot of people acknowledged for decades that the right in various manifestations has been working to destroy confidence in basically every kind of educated elite, the scientists, the academics, all of that, the media, they're all liars. And that has been annoying, distressing in a lot of ways, but it really does seem potentially like apocalyptically fatal in this case. So what can we do? How do we reassure people that they should not be listening to Brian Kemp or to Donald Trump when it comes to coronavirus, that they should be listening to the doctors? The WHO conspiracy theories that you're talking about are unlikely to be true just because some YouTuber said that they're true. Well, what are some ways that we can respond to what we're seeing?
Look, I understand that, elite scientists and epidemiologists are seen as far removed from people who are most at risk, and working class people, populism, and people in many senses who are most at risk of contracting the virus because they don't have, the types of luxuries that allow them to actually have distance from other people. But what we really need, and we were trying to build upon this with the Sanders campaign that I was so proud to be part of, so honored to be part of, but what we really, really need are people who can activate the masses, in a sense, public communicators, politicians, really, who can take up the mantle and say, hey, we understand why you have distrust of hypocritical liberal elite institutions. We understand where you're coming from. However, here's some guidance that is going to allow us all to have a healthcare system that really works for everybody, because we should never turn back. We should never allow the same broken system to be what comes out at us on the other side. The post-pandemic world needs to be fundamentally changed in a way that supports all of us who are at risk because of our broken system.
Yeah.
We should distrust these broken politicians who are basically responsible for many deaths. But most importantly, we need to revolutionize our larger system here in this country and in many parts of the world, establish public banks, figure out ways for stimulus funding to support workers, follow the lead of striking nurses, of striking Amazon employees, of striking Instacart employees, really revive our traditional institutions, not elite, liberal, hypocritical, neoliberal institutions, which, gave rise to the Trump, and neo-fascist wing that we see all over the world, in India, in Brazil, in Hungary, in the Philippines, and so on. But a new transformation that people can trust that starts from the people. So that's what we were attempting to do with our campaign, and we're going to keep building on that. I'm not despondent. I'm ready to go still.
It seems like right now, considering the challenges that we were already facing before coronavirus, now we have these new changes. And look, you were just talking about how we don't want to go back to various elements of the system that were already broken. Like, what an opportunity it would be right now were Bernie Sanders to be the nominee, to make that not just the centerpiece of his campaign, but of the Democratic Party's strategy, their approach going forward. It's horrible. We don't have that opportunity now. So, all of us, I think, are trying to figure out what comes next. What do we do? I'm curious how you felt when it was winding down. And obviously, you seem fired up for the future. So tell me, what do we do? What are the next steps going forward? If we're going to organize, if we're going to push in the direction that you've been talking about.
Look, you guys have covered this as well as anyone. What Bernie and has contributed to our country, and in many cases has spilled over in other parts of the world, is nothing less of wonderful, incredible. And I have so much personally gratitude for what Bernie has done for our country. He picked up the mantle, honestly, of Occupy Wall Street and brought it into political conversation, where now every major issue that he fought for and advocated for is on people's minds, is part of potentially a legislative transformation. It may not happen now. It didn't happen with our campaign, but it can happen. And we have to figure out how to recombine, pick up not even the pieces, but pick up all of these parts of what our campaign was about and push them forward, like public banking, you know, like universal healthcare, like, you know, debt relief, like universal education, you know, debt-free colleges and universities. All of these things are entirely possible. But I think the key thing that actually stopped our campaign in its tracks to some extent were two major forces, actually three. One was the mainstream neoliberal media, basically not, you know, not giving us coverage and really, you know, essentially pretending like we were a threat to the American people with all sorts of scare tactics. You know, we've all covered it on the Young Turks, right? Mm-hmm. That's one. Two is our the activity, the energy of our movement really came from in-person, person-to-person connections. Of course, we use the internet to bring people together as well. But it was really, you remember this, John, it was all about the rallies and it was all about the canvassing. I mean, why did we do so well with the Latinx communities in Nevada and in California? It's because we were working in those neighborhoods, in those communities. People in the campaign, I work really closely with people. I was so proud and honored to be a surrogate for the campaign. These guys are legit. I mean, they come from neighborhoods in East LA, all over the state we were working in. And I think that was another big part. And of course, there was the last part, which was the, you know, the deck of cards that was stacked against us with the Democratic establishment. And specifically, I think we have some evidence that President Obama was behind this, basically getting people to drop out and pulled, you know, put, you know, divide and conquer and kind of basically have them all in line to support Biden. We'll see how that turns out. But I think more than ever, we need to understand that Trump is an existential threat to our country and our world, and we have to push Biden in every way possible. So our campaign, you know, we should not see success or failure in a single primary season. We have to look at it as an arc, an arc of political aspiration and political transformation. And that's what we've done here. And that is irrevocably that has transformed in this country. And this pandemic gives us huge opportunities not to just prop up the same old neoliberal systems that have now turned into neo-fascist systems, but to actually transform things in the opposite way of the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein has written about.
You know, I hope this doesn't seem like a weird question, but so when Bernie suspended his campaign, and, you know, a lot of us had to realize that he's unlikely to be the nominee. He's unlikely to run again. A lot of people's like first thought was, well, if Bernie is not the leader, then who is the leader of the movement? And that's, of course, ignoring the fact that just because he's not running for president doesn't mean he's suddenly going to go away and just start painting in the woods or something like that. He's not gone. But even if he was, do you think we need to find the next leader? Do you care if there's one leader? Is that what we should be focusing on? What do you think about all this?
That's such a good question. I mean, John, honestly, I've been asking myself and others that question as well. Obviously, we have a number of young leaders who have entered into Congress, who are also also people in the organizer world as well, who have gotten attention. I mean, we're talking about the Justice Democrats. You know, you all have. The Young Turks are a huge part of what made that happen. Honestly, that's why I've been so psyched to join you guys over the years. I think more than anything, what Bernie did appeal to was some aspects, if you will, of, it's a bit of a myth, but of mainstream America, you know, kind of working class Americans across the political spectrum who might actually say, hey, this guy is legit. He's actually talking about issues that all of us agree with, right? Look at Medicare for All. So I think what we need to do is kind of be patient, let people emerge and see who, and it's probably a few people, but who are those people who in a legit way are going to speak to and have the integrity of working people and working families' concerns? So, you know, obviously we have the AOCs and Ilhan Omars of the world, and they're going to be part of this moving forward. But I think there are others who are going to have to rise up and step into the middle and really figure out a way to communicate with people, right? And I think Bernie did that very well. But we have to kind of emerge more and more and more. And I think we need to cultivate and build on that spirit that we had in the past. But I do think we are in a bit of a lull and we are in a bit of a vacuum. And this pandemic has certainly forced that situation. And the pandemic honestly didn't help our campaign at all. We had to disappear. We took the campaign to raising money for people to heal from the virus. You know, this is the integrity of what our campaign was about. And people do understand that.
Yeah. And I know also that Bernie is helping out people who worked on his campaign in terms of health insurance and that going forward, the sort of pledge that Mike Bloomberg said he was going to do and then went back on, Bernie's right. actually making good on.
He's a man of his word, you know, I mean, he's a mensch.
Above everything else, that is the case. and I know we've mostly been talking about the United States, but I know that you're part of an organization that is trying to take this more international.
Yes. This is where we go, you know, something that might be seen as failure from a very static lens of looking at things actually belies the way history functions. Every system of plutocratic, oligarchic, and hateful fascist power has been overturned by movements. And our campaign was a snapshot as part of a larger movement, right? And those movements are not just temporal, they're not just over time, but they're also spatial and geographical. And what we see happening, I mean, look at the remarkable growth of all these, you know, groups like food banks, you know, like mutual aid groups, like self-help groups. This is ballooning up all over the world. And people don't notice that because we're just paying attention to Trump and all of his hateful rhetoric. But in reality, we see a lot of community-based organizations, a lot of labor-based movements bubbling up in our country and around the world. And additionally, and this is what you were asking me about, John, we also see the formation of international progressive coalitions. And I think that's very important. Specifically, I am very excited, and Noam Chomsky actually mentioned this on Democracy Now! Just last week, of a movement that has part of its home in Europe, that folks like Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek minister of economics, who quit the government because they bought into the austerity measures imposed upon them by Greece. He has started, along with his compatriots across the world, a linking together of all progressive movements and progressive coalitions. And so this is a progressive international movement that's starting to happen. We're going to be meeting across different borders, talking to one another. We're probably going to be doing a lot of meetings in person, but we're talking about progressive movements from South America, very important, across the global South, Africa, Asia, South America, Europe, and North America. So we're going to be, and of course, Australia as well. So there are these movements afoot, John, and you guys know this, across the world. So what we need to do is come together and figure out what are our points of intersection and what are the ways we can start to chip at this oligarchic power that has created so much trouble in the world.
I'm not going to lie. That's got me pretty excited.
Please join us, man.
This seems long overdue.
Please join us. You know, if you are interested in joining us, I would like to bring the Young Turks into the fold.
Definitely.
Here. I've been talking to these guys for a couple of years. I'm super psyched about this. I'm a very optimistic person. You know, you guys know this, but I actually always see opportunities for more and more transformation. And I think this pandemic is a disaster. And I feel so much compassion for people who are at risk and whose health have taken a turn for the worse or who have passed away in their families. But I also see this as an opportunity, and we should not lose this opportunity for massive transformation. We should not let Trump appropriate the language of progressive culture when he is a pathological liar and is actually just doing things that are the opposite of what he says.
Yeah. No, in any way I can be involved or can help, I would love to. Thank you. And thank you also for joining us, Ramesh. It's great to check in with you and to get your thoughts on these very important issues, not just the coronavirus, but also, I mean, you having been involved so much with the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, my heart goes out to everyone who was even closer to it and obviously must be even more affected by the end of it. But the, you know, optimistic, forward-looking approach that you have, I need that. I think a lot of our audience probably needs that too. So we really appreciate you joining us today.
We're going to take the bull by the horns, man. Everybody, come talk to me. I'm available to everybody. I'm on Twitter. I think you guys are showing that. Just know that this is going to keep happening. This is going to keep pushing. And we need the vehicle of the Young Turks. We need other networks. We need to break into mainstream media. I'm trying to write op-eds that in fairly subversive or framed ways are trying to make these arguments for mainstream media. Join us. We are going to make this happen. And Bernie has helped us get to this point, but we're going to take it further. We are young progressives. We are people who believe in compassion and justice. We're not radicals. We believe in a humane world, and we can get there. And this virus, this pandemic, if anything, shows us that we need this to happen, and we need to start pushing. We need to come together, and we can do it. We can do it now.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it, John. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.